This is Fresh Air. George Will has written a new book, Making the Case for Congressional Term Limits. It's called Restoration, and we discussed it in the first half of today's show. Will is back to talk with us about politics, journalism, and his own political evolution. Will writes a syndicated newspaper column, a Newsweek column, and he's a panelist each Sunday morning on ABC's This Week with David Brinkley. When you're interviewing newsmakers on The Brinkley Show on Sundays, do you think that they come in with a sense of what it is they're going to tell you that's going to make news? I mean, do you think that they've spoken to their aides and said, okay, we'll tell them this, but we won't tell them any more than that?
Oh, I think so. I think they know why they're coming on our show. I sometimes wonder why anyone does come on our show.
What makes you wonder that?
What's in it for them? I mean, they have Will and Donaldson and Brinkley are there to try and get them to say something that will make news. Now, generally, that means say something indiscreet, controversial, inconsistent with what they've said in the past. I'm not saying we're being cynical about this, but something that moves along, advances the public conversation in this country.
Mm-hmm.
A politician wants to control the pace and evolution of that public conversation. And he or she has a great many ways in political life of getting their views out. They can hold press conferences, they can issue press releases, they can give set speeches. Why come on and do it on our show? I'm glad they do, believe me. I mean, it keeps us in business. But at times I wonder. Now, clearly one reason they do is that on Sunday morning we have a very, not a huge, but a quality audience. And it's a way of getting in the Monday papers, of dominating a slow news day, of getting your view out. So, of course, they should have, if they're going to come on our show, they should have a kind of media strategy that they're advancing. And if they're good, and frankly, by the time you get senior enough in American public life that a show like The Brinkley Show wants to have you on, you are good at it. They will come on, and it doesn't matter too much what we ask them.
Now, I'm interested in your political evolution. I believe your parents were Democrats, and I know in 1960, when you were at Trinity College, you headed the Trinity Students for Kennedy. So obviously, when you were younger, you weren't yet conservative. Can you tell us something about the formative experiences in your life,
it's all personal
and political?
It's in 1 Corinthians. Then I put away childish things. Actually, it's interesting you ask that because in recent days, President Bush has been saying the problem with Clinton is he went to Oxford and became a left-winger. I went to Oxford between 62 through 64 and came back and voted for Goldwater. So Oxford can have different effects on you. I went to England. I saw the Berlin Wall, which was rather young at that point. I watched in England what I took to be the suffocating effects of a recklessly growing state of collectivism, both in the Tory Party and in the Socialist Labor Party. Became acquainted with the writings of Milton Friedman and Friedrich von Hayek, and indeed some sort of Hayekian people at a little group in London called the Institute of Economic Affairs, which was nourishing the intellectual growth at that time of a young politician from the Midlands named Margaret Thatcher. So I was sort of present in England and at Oxford when free market economics and the kind of conservatism that we associate with that was gaining an intellectual pedigree.
So free market economics was the first thing to change in your political philosophy.
Well, it was the belief that government is a blunt instrument, that markets are remarkably equitable and efficient allocators of wealth and opportunity. Then I did come back and went to graduate school at Princeton and then went into teaching. So I was on college campuses, here or abroad, as an undergraduate, graduate student, or a professor all through the 1960s. And I am one of those whose conservatism owes something to the student radicalism of the 60s when I became quite struck by the ferocity of the passions loose and of the fragility of institutions such as universities.
So did you feel that as the campuses kept becoming more radical that...
I kept getting more conservative.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
What about cultural ideas? Did they... was that simultaneous with your political change? Did you change culturally as well?
Well, I did. I became convinced that it is part of government's job to look after certain values, certain moral attributes that are the prerequisites of, are assumed for democracy. I actually, by 1981, when I gave the Godkin lectures at Harvard and then produced a book called Statecraft to Soulcraft, I'd formulated this, saying that, in fact, government cannot help but take sides on certain broad cultural questions. We do it with what we criminalize or decriminalize, with what kind of schools we have and who goes to the schools and what we teach and all the rest, and through our civic liturgy, what we encourage, what we reward, what we praise, and that we ought to think about it, because indeed democracy does presuppose a complicated, subtle network of values and capacities on the part of the public that tyrannies needn't worry about.
My guest is political columnist George Will. He's written a new book about congressional term limits called Restoration. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is George Will. He's the author of a new book called Restoration, Congress, Term Limits, and the Recovery of Deliberative Democracy. Now, in an article in Esquire magazine, William Henry III called you a national version of the smartest boy in the class. Were you the smartest boy in the class during grade school?
Good God, no. I don't remember grade school. I went to the university high school on the University of Illinois campus in Champaign-Urbana, and I was far from the smartest kid in my class.
How did you do?
I did all right, but I think we had a small class of about 33, and I think a third of them were merit scholar finalists. I certainly wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Did your parents encourage you to do a lot of schoolwork, your father being a professor, your mother a high school teacher?
I don't think so. I think all I cared about was baseball, and I played basketball with stunning badness, but I played it. And I couldn't have played at a larger school, so I was really interested in sports.
You know that thing about the image of being the smartest boy in the class? You know, on television, one of the things that's given you that image is the glasses that you wear, the bow ties that you used to wear.
My 11-year-old daughter says that I look like the perfect nerd. So I think that has something to do with it.
Well, I wonder if you ran into the kind of Gloria Steinem problem in the sense that once the media and the nation associates you with a certain pair of glasses, you cannot change them.
Well, actually, you know, it's interesting. I used to wear bow ties a lot just because I liked them, and it seemed to be a kind of statement or a costume, so I haven't worn them so much recently.
Mm-hmm. And the glasses?
Actually, these glasses I got in Aspen at a place, and I think they were originally made for John Denver. Seriously, I think they were trying to make John Denver look more grown up. And they designed these, and I'm not sure whether he wanted them or not, but anyway, I got them.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I think that's the case. It's been a while.
And you're not kidding about that?
No, to the Aspen Optical Shop. I'm sure they could tell me if I called them up.
Do you think that the nature of your conservatism has changed over the years?
I'm a little more skeptical of government than I once was. I once was, in fact, when I wrote Statecraft to Soulcraft, I was a little more sympathetic to the welfare state and to what I was trying to define strong government conservatism. I am less sanguine today about the modern state as an instrument of reform and as a supplementer of market forces. And that's one reason why I'm for term limits.
You have a son who has Down syndrome, and I wonder if that's affected your thoughts at all about government responsibility for caring for others.
It has made me sympathetic to families who didn't have the means that I have to provide for him, even if the government hadn't been there. I've made good use, I hope and think, for my son of public services, particularly in Montgomery County, Maryland, and I'm very grateful to to Montgomery County and the other jurisdictions that have provided services for him. And as I say, I've been particularly alert to how anguishing it would be if I had no alternatives. And so people less fortunate than I understand how desperately important these are to them. It's a classic example of where government doing things that people cannot do for themselves.
I want to ask you something that's really old news, but I just want to kind of get your sense of it. During the 1980 president debate, you were a participant in the coaching of Ronald Reagan, and you were very criticized by that by many journalists who felt that you had kind of breached the line between journalism and politics, and that what made it worse was that you analyzed the debate for ABC television without mentioning that you had coached Ronald Reagan. So what are your thoughts about that now, looking back on
it? Well, I shouldn't have done it. It does breach a line. I should say it's a line really drawn for my benefit. When Walter Lippmann was coaching Adlai Stevenson and others, and when Edward R. Murrow was giving Adlai Stevenson television lessons, the line wasn't drawn then, but it got drawn with some clarity for my benefit, and I'll accept the line as given. The idea that Ronald Reagan needed a lot of coaching from the likes of me is, of course, preposterous, but what I did was I participated in the debate preparation, asking him questions, and not long and not many, but some, and I shouldn't have done it. I'm not quite racked with guilt over the fact that I then went on to analyze the debate for two reasons. First of all, it was hardly a state secret who I was in favor of. And indeed, I'm sure I was on Nightline that night representing the conservative media that supported Reagan. Second, what I said after the debate was that Reagan won it decisively, and he did.
Where was your mind changed? Because after the debate, when you were called on this, you defended your action, and now you're saying that lines like that are drawn for the benefit of journalists. So,
this line was drawn for my benefit,
right?
Because when others were supporting liberals, they didn't care, to be blunt.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. See, there was no uproar when Edward R. Murrow coached Adlai Stevenson, or when Walter Lippmann was involved with all kinds of people. He was a very active participant in the political process. But I think people got a little exercised when a conservative was involved.
But anyways, when did your mind change about the...
Well, when I saw how the controversy did confuse people and they said, well, what are the rules and shouldn't we have a cleaner demarcation? And I said, fine, that probably is a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, the effect of the end of the Cold War on your politics and your priorities. I mean, you became a conservative during the Cold War. It was the beginning of the wall in Germany. The wall's a thing of the past. The Cold War is a thing of the past. Has that fundamentally changed you in any way?
Well, it's opened up wonderful, inspiriting possibilities. That indeed we can, as I say, restore Congress, shrink the presidency. Revitalize our democracy, dismantle some of the national security state. I hasten to stress that I think the Cold Warriors of both parties are the great heroes of American history. It's the most important war ever waged, and the Cold Warriors come out of it covered with glory. And I, from Truman and Acheson through Reagan and his supporters. There's nothing wrong with the Cold War, but it did inevitably have a distorting effect on the structure and conversation of the federal government. And it's good to be back to being just a normal country in a normal period again, rather than the vanguard of a resistance to a nation that considered itself a different historical stage, the Soviet Union.
One last question for you. One of the things that you're very well known for is always quoting political historians and philosophers and so on. Do you when you come across a quote that's of interest to you, have a place that you could store it in so that you can get access to it when you want to refer to it?
No, I don't use computers or word processors over there. I write everything with a fountain pen, so I don't store things. Usually if I quote something, and I think I do it less than I used to and less than people think, but usually when I quote something, that tells you what I'm reading at the moment.
What are you reading at the moment now?
Right at the moment, I'm reading a novel called Clockers.
Oh, Richard Price's novel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Yeah, it is.
And
Now tell me why you're reading that. That's really, it's a novel about teenagers selling crack cocaine and about the police who police the neighborhood.
Yeah, well, it's sort of Bonfire of the Vanities without the cartoonish element. I mean, this is real American realism of the sort Tom Wolfe advocates. And it does what literature does. It takes you into a world that is strange to you.
Would Richard Price, the author, ever end up on the Sunday Show?
It's conceivable.
Right.
Sure. And I may write a column. I'm a little late now on this, but it's the sort of novel I sometimes write columns about.
Right. Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Glad to.
George Will writes a column for Newsweek as well as a syndicated newspaper column. He's a panelist on ABC's This Week with David Brinkley. Will has written a new book in support of congressional term limits called Restoration. This is Fresh Air.